Good morning. I'm Liam Burke, Managing Director at B. Riley Securities. I'd like to open up by thanking Nicholas and the entire Capital Link organization for putting together a great day with impressive panels. I'm a little biased, some more impressive than others. I'd also like to thank our panelists for sharing their ideas with us, and finally for the audience for listening to this. What I'd like to do is introduce our panelists one at a time. This is a broad topic, but I'd like to give maybe a minute or so on your individual businesses. And then obviously as we get to the panel, we'll go into the businesses and the macro in a little more detail. So starting with Christian Sorensen, CEO of BWLPG, I'd like him to introduce him and we'll move down after that. Christian.
Thank you. So should I say a few words about the company? Or
just a minute or so.
Yeah, so BWLPG is the world's largest owner and operator of very large gas carriers. We are operating in the same segment as our good friends and competitors in Dorian with TED. And of course, for us in our industry, what's going on here in the States with oil, with everything on the shale oil and shale gas side, has been a fantastic journey for us, and it seems to continue. So I think we'll also touch upon that later in the panel.
Yeah, we will. Yes, we will. Mr. Jerry Calogaratos, Capital Clean Energy Corporation, CEO. Welcome, Jerry.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jerry Calogaratos, CEO of Capital Clean Energy Carriers. We own and operate the largest U.S.-listed fleet of two-stroke vessels. That's 12 LNG carriers in the water and another six new builds coming between 2026-2027. We have 7 years of charter backlog, $2.5 billion of contracted revenue. And in addition to that, we also have another 10 multi-gas carriers that can operate in the LPG and ammonia business, be it, of course, gray or low-carbon ammonia. That includes also four liquid CO2 carriers, which are the first of their type in the world, and as we target to play a major role in the transportation of energy transition cargoes.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Richard Tyrrell, CEO of Cool Company Limited.
Hi, my name is Richard Tyrrell, and I'm the chief exec of Coolco. We are a company that's got 13 LNG carriers, which are on contracts of varying lengths. It's a portfolio that's worth about $1 billion in backlog. Typically, we have a couple of open ships within the subsequent 6 months, which, of course, right now is hard work, and I'm sure we're going to get into that. However, it is a sector which has great upside. LNG is very much the transition fuel of the future, and Coolco is there to transport it on behalf of its customers.
Thank you, Richard. Next, we have Mr. Ted Young, CFO of Dorian LPG Limited.
Thanks, Liam. Yeah, Ted Young, Dorian LPG. As Christian pointed out, we're both active in the VLGC sector. Best, cheapest way to transport a metric ton of LPG long haul. You know, we're similarly enjoying the benefits of the U.S. export boom and, you know, the Chinese and Indian import booms, and I'm sure we'll discuss that more as we go on.
Thank you. And finally, last but not least, Mr. Randy Givens, EVP, Head of IR and Business Development at Navigator Gas.
One yeah. Minute. Thanks, Liam. So Navigator Gas, we're the world's largest owner and best operator of handy-sized LPG carriers. Our 59 vessels transport an array of cargoes and commodities, ethane, ethylene, propane, propylene, butane, butadiene, and ammonia. So pretty diversified player there. We also own 50% of an ethylene export terminal with our partner Enterprise Products Partners. That's down in the Houston Ship Channel at Morgan's Point.
Thank you, Randy. I'd like to start with the macro and specifically LPG. Ted, could you give us a near-term and long-term outlook of the view? And then Christian, if you could add to that, that would be great. So, Ted.
That's a nice, easy question to start the day. Yeah, I'd say, you know, I think we remain pretty sanguine about what we see, you know, going forward. You know, U.S. LPG is a byproduct of LNG and oil production. We continue to see a fairly robust production outlook, particularly here in the U.S., but also in the Middle East. We see export capacity coming online in the U.S. Middle of this year and end of this year and then into 26. You know, we continue to see that LPG is taking market share in the petrochemical sector. It continues to enjoy nice organic growth in the retail sector, heating and cooking. You know, and over the next, you know, this year we've got a pretty modest order book. Next year it's a bit bigger, but all seems, you know, manageable in the near term. So from a medium-term perspective, which is about as long-term as I can go in shipping, I think we feel pretty solid about what we're seeing.
Christian? Yeah, just to echo that, you know, the underlying commodity story in our markets is very solid with the continued exports from the States and also later in this decade from the Middle East. Like you said, you know, the on the demand side, even though it's a supply-driven market, we can see that the demand side for LPG is growing steadily. And I think you can see markets, for instance, in India, in the future also Africa, which will be big demand centers for the commodity, in addition to the current big drivers in Northeast Asia, including China, Japan, and Korea. So the underlying commodity story in our shipping segment is very robust, the way we see it.
Great. Thank you, Christian. Randy, could you share with us, you haul other commodities outside of LPG. Tell us your outlook for some of the non-LPG commodities.
Sure. It's a pretty similar story as Ted and Christian were talking. You know, the demand for vessels for shipping is really based on the supply of the underlying commodities. We're seeing a lot more growth in NGL production here in the U.S., as well as fractionation capacity, right? That's stripping out the ethane, the propane, the butane. So that really demands a lot for our vessels. So we're seeing that firsthand. Almost all of our ethane, ethylene carriers have been transporting ethane in recent months. A lot of that's just due to the domestic crackers, the U.S. crackers that are cracking the ethane into ethylene, going through maintenance and turnarounds in the near term. So obviously our ships have kind of shifted, doing more ethane. Now we're starting to see that ethylene arbitrage starting to widen, meaning the U.S. producers are now starting to produce more ethylene. So that is reducing the price domestically. International prices are still fairly high. So it's really an arbitrage play for us. We see that both from the ethane-ethylene story. On the propane side, that's more of a regional trade. We're not taking the large lots from the U.S. Gulf to Asia, like Dorian and BW are. But we're doing much more regional, kind of shorter-haul trades on that. But also ammonia, and that's the third leg we stand on. And we're seeing that ton-mile demand remain robust, especially after Russia-Ukraine started in 2022. We're 3 years into that, and still we have 9 vessels transporting ammonia. So supply and demand fundamentals are very good across various commodities that we're carrying. On the supply side of ships, when you look at the order book for handy size carriers, it's only around 10%, and that's spread into 2028. So we think the supply hurdle is pretty low for us to eclipse in terms of the demand growth for our vessels.
Thank you, Randy. Richard, can we jump to you on the outlook on LNG?
Sure. So the outlook on LNG in the long term is really exceptional. However, in the short term, there's a few factors which have been weighing on the market. One thing that has been absent from the market recently is the arbitrage. So just like for LPG, LNG has an arbitrage between the Pacific Basin and the Atlantic Basin. And of late, a lot of the cargoes have been going into Europe and not going into Asia, which has reduced the demand for shipping. There's not been a contango in the market, so there's been a reduced demand for storage as well. However, you know, we do see that changing. And why will that change? Well, more LNG is coming into the market. There's now a lot of visibility on the LNG that's coming in to the market. A lot of that's coming into the U.S., and, of course, the distance from the U.S. to other markets is longer than it is from other locations. So that'll have a positive impact on shipping. Now, of course, some of the new builds which were built to lift these volumes delivered early, which is typically the way it is in LNG. But those early deliveries will be worked through over time. So that's at one end of the stick. At the other end of the stick, we're going to see a lot of idle vessels. The older vessels are going to be idled because they're too small and they're too inefficient. They have boil off, which makes them too inefficient. Initially, the scrapping looked like it was slow, but that really understates the number of vessels that are being idled. And fundamentally, these old steamships, when they come off their 20-year charters, which started in the early 2000s, which basically means now there is no role for them within the market. And there are at least 100 ships that we see leaving the market in the relatively near term. And those ships leaving will help balance things out.
Jerry, anything, anything you could add to the LNG, but I'd also like you to add, you've got some other commodities that you're looking past on the LNG, if you could share, like liquid CO2, if you could share with us your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Liam. And, no, I think Richard covered it very well. There is indeed right now a delta between, let's say, the expected LNG capacity that would be coming online this year compared to what's actually has come online. Maybe the delta is almost 30 MTPA, which is quite substantial. But a lot of that, delay is going to be really come online back in 2026 and 2027. So when you look at the market and the supply and demand balance, it's pretty clear that by the end of 26, early 27, the market does not only balance, but we expect that it will run into deficit given what the order book is today. And you can see that also being reflected in period rates, right? I mean, one-year period rate is closer to 30,000, but if you're looking at a 7-10-year charter rate for delivery 2027-2028, it's probably closer to 90,000. And I think that shows you how that market is inverted. So you asked about our other exposure. So we have also 6 MGCs and 4 liquid CO2 carriers. Actually, our 4 liquid CO2 carriers are handy LPG multi-gas carriers. So whatever was covered by my peers here on the panel about those markets is very much in place. It's a market, the handy LPG market, where there is a very small order book, and actually our 4 ships is a big part of that very small order book. But for us, really, the bet is on the LCO2 market as we look into the future. 2025 actually is quite an important year for the CCUS market. I'm talking about now onshore, right? We expect that we will go from about 95 MTPA to about 120 MTPA materializing in terms of onshore CCUS capacity. And at the same time, we have a number of, maritime CCUS projects coming online. The first one, the most high profile, is, of course, Northern Lights. Northern Lights is ready, also a couple of ships have been delivered. It's about to start operations. That's about 1.5 MTPA, and then it's expected to grow further to 5 MTPA over the next 5 years. Then you have the Stella Maris project, a major project in Europe. It has received 200 million euros, and it's expected to go up to 10 MTPA. And then you have a number of, the usual suspects, BET, Eni, Total, NISC, the Japanese government, the Korean government, BASF, talking about emitters, Lafarge, all of them having right now live projects that have a time horizon for materialization, let's say, by 2028, 2030. So to cut a long story short on this, if you look at most analysts' expectations, it is for about 90 MTPA of maritime LCO2 being moved by 2030, which would translate somewhere to around 70 ships. Now, even if you were to divide this by two, you're very conservative, the only ships that are right now on order are the ships that go into Northern Lights, and our four liquid CO2 carriers in a market where shipbuilding capacity for such type of vessels is extremely limited.
Thank you, Jerry. Each of the companies here, of your companies, have very different business models in terms of not only fleet strategies, but there are, as Randy mentioned, some adjacencies that they invest in, looking as they look at the macro. So I guess we could start with Christian and just go right down the panel on the individual business models of each of your businesses.
Sure. Yeah, BW LPG, of course, we're primarily a VLGC shipping company. But we do also have substantial activity in other parts of the value chain in LPG, especially on the trading side, where we have our team in BW Product Services trading about 5 to 6 million tons of physical LPG every year. That's kind of in the second tier compared to the Vitols and the Trafiguras of this world. And that's been an important part of our business model over the last couple of years to increase the revenue stream, give us more flexibility, optionality in the way that we also employ our own ships. It's also giving us the opportunity to capture profit in the LPG value chain when shipping is under pressure, like we exemplified back in the fourth quarter. So this has been an important part of our business model also going forward, in addition to our core business, which is shipping. In addition to that, we have a growing presence in India. We do have, for quite some time now, had the largest fleet of Indian flagged VLGCs. We even announced today that we are going to transfer two more ships into the Indian flagged entity. And we believe in the LPG story in India, so we have also started to invest in infrastructure on the distribution side of LPG in India. So India is another market for us where we believe that we can expand our platform. But of course, shipping remains the core of what we're doing. But we believe that through the move into adjacent parts of the value chain that we can take out some of the volatility in earnings that our company typically has been suffering from, especially in the downturns, which can be quite brutal. Just a last comment on the way that we operate our VLGC fleet outside of India, the conventional fleet. I think it's fair to say that we probably have a slightly more conservative chartering strategy than Dorian has. We have typically 30 to 40% of our fleet capacity tied up on time charters. And we use that as a hedge and kind of a downside protection to the volatility that we see in the market. So that's kind of the business model that we operate in, briefly explained.
Thank you, Christian. Jerry?
Well, our business is, of course, gas transportation solutions across the gas range. The idea is to cater predominantly to the movement of LNG, but also LPG and other types of conventional cargos, but also having optionality towards energy transition, gas cargos that are coming online, such as liquid CO2 or low carbon ammonia. The way that we do this is always with first class, very high specification assets. Today we own the most modern LNG fleet out there, very high specification fleet, two stroke, mostly second generation two stroke vessels. We like to keep some market exposure, but also have some contracted revenues. So today we have, as I said at the beginning, 2.5 billion of contracted revenues with a number of different parties and 7 years of remaining charter duration. But we also have open ships in 2026-27 when we think that the market will balance. And at the same time, we have building growth. We have a new building program of the LNG carriers as well as the LPG multi-gas carriers. That's about 2.3 billion, which is fully funded from cash at hand, the sale of certain legacy assets. We expect these vessels to come online from 26-27. So building growth as well.
Thank you, Richard.
Coolco is very much a pure play LNG shipping company. So with Coolco, you get exposure to that market. From a how do we manage the business? Well, we do look to take a portfolio approach to the charters, and that's a risk mitigation strategy. We've got at one end a 14-year charter, and that's the longest charter we have. At the other end, we've got vessels coming open later this year. And yeah, obviously, we look to get the right balance of the two. We also look to adjust the balance sheet so that you can withstand slightly weaker markets. And we've been sort of taking care of that recently. We've pushed out our debt maturities out to 2029. And when it comes to growth, there may be opportunities in a downturn like this. And we will look at them. However, when you're comparing the opportunities you see in the market, you've got to compare those with buying back your own shares and the value which you can achieve through that. And we never lose focus of that.
Thank you. Ted?
yeah, I'd say Christian helpfully drew some of the comparisons. So we don't have those ancillary businesses. You know, we get, as a company, we get de facto exposure to India, either from the ships we have deployed in the Middle East or just general market exposure. You know, our view on the trading and the terminaling is they're certainly interesting, and it's a way to play it. I think our view has just been from a capital markets perspective, investors can usually diversify better for themselves than we can, and so that's sort of the reason that we've stuck to the core VLGC business. I'd say in terms of chartering strategy, Christian, I think we're probably fairly similar because we've been right around 33% charter coverage. May not always be obvious because I'm including the ships we have in the Helios pool, which, you know, and again, I don't think there's a magic number, and I'm not sure Christian thinks there's a magic number either. I think, you know, the trick is to you know, I think it's probably sort of like getting married. When you find the right one, you know it. And so when the right charter opportunity comes in terms of duration, quality of charterer, and of course rate, you know, then you sort of say, all right, I think we'll do this. On the other hand, it's obviously always tempered by, you know, the medium-term outlook and, you know, in our case, COAs on which ships are deployed. So, you know, there are some differences between our approach and BW's, but same fundamental market drivers. And you know, I think shareholders are generally pretty well rewarded recently in both shares.
Randy?
Yeah, when it comes to shipping, Navigator Gas is probably the least volatile in terms of rates, right, over the last 10, 11 years. Our rate range has been low 20s to kind of mid $30,000 per day. EBITDA breakevens of 10,000, cash breakevens of 20, and we've been EBITDA positive as well as cash flow positive every quarter since existence, right? So that volatility isn't really there per se in our segment, coupled with our terminal, right? We have the 50% ownership of the ethylene export terminal, so that even more stabilizes those cash flows and that earnings volatility. Now we're 90% shipping, about 10% terminal. We expect both to grow, but we've done the expansion on the ethylene export terminal. We're looking at other terminals, both from an export side here in the U.S., Canada as well, but also on the import side, be it in Asia or Europe. And obviously that stabilizes those cash flows even further, but it also helps support our shipping business. Export terminals kind of push cargoes onto our vessels. The import terminals pull cargoes from our vessels. So it really gives us a kind of a fuller supply chain for the transportation, but also the helping production, helping consumption around the world. We've also done other investments. We've invested in a blue ammonia export terminal, put a couple million dollars into that with a larger option upon FID in 2027, Zane Fuel Solutions for ammonia bunkering, Blue Streak joint venture for CO2 transportation. So we have a lot of other ancillary investments, but again, that all supports our shipping business, right? Our shipping of ethylene, our shipping of ammonia, eventually clean ammonia, and then CO2 as well.
Thank you, Randy. I'd like to stay with you and then come back. Just as a follow-on, I think a capital investment is fleet renewal, fleet maintenance. Do you have any major capital projects over the next 3 years? And in the context of those capital projects or your capital needs, What do you do with your excess cash?
Yeah, good question. Just this morning, we announced that we tapped our unsecured bonds, coupon of 7.25 fixed, right? Those go through 2029. So it's the tightest credit spread and margin in unsecured bond history, right? So that $40 million of additional liquidity is really just to replenish our balance sheet. We paid our stub payment of $50 million in late December for that ethylene expansion for that terminal. So now we kind of boosted our cash balance by another $40 million as of this morning. So in terms of uses of capital, you know, we have a couple new buildings on order, but those will be debt financed even during the pre-delivery phase. Our balance sheet, our debt is already low, 2.4 times net debt to EBITDA, 34% or so net debt to cap. So we are under-levered already in terms of terminals and other expansion there. We have some projects potential, but no real CapEx commitments for the next few years. So that's not really a need for capital. So really that leaves share buybacks, frankly, right? When you're trading at a 40% discount to NAV, when you're trading at, I don't know, five times EV/EBITDA multiples, that's probably the best use of incremental dollars. So we expect to be a little more active on the share buyback front. We've done $50 million in open market purchases in 23. We did a $51 million block transaction in June of 24. So we're expecting more of the same here in 2025.
Thank you, Randy. Ted?
We have one major investment project, or fairly major. We have we're taking delivery of one ammonia-capable VLGC next year. It's, you know, given our cash position, we're in pretty good shape in terms of financing it. And we've been generating cash, and we've been very active dividend payers since September of 21. We've sort of deployed all three options in terms of excess cash. We've done open market repurchases. We did a self-tender offer, so very, you know, open, and, you know, market-driven auction kind of approach, and then we've paid dividends. And, you know, while there is certainly a lot of, you know, the basic finance math says, yeah, you ought to be always buying back your shares and trading at a discount, I think where we've seen the biggest pop in our total shareholder return, which is how we're motivated and paid, is from dividends. And, you know, we've debated this a lot with peers and analysts and everybody else, and I think we've come to the conclusion that in a more volatile sector, investors really prize the de-risking of the investment that comes from a dividend versus sort of a binary decision that they may or may not be making, because usually in an open market repurchase, they don't know if you're out there, you know, of, gee, do I want to increase my exposure or reduce my exposure? You know, a dividend allows an investor to decide what he or she wants to do, and every investor, of course, has different needs and different desires. So, you know, we still have plenty of authority under our stock buyback authority, and we'll continue to, you know, take advantage of that opportunistically. But you know, I think we continue to see good investor feedback and good shareholder returns from paying dividends.
Thank you, Ted.
So we've got a $70 million investment program in our ships, and it's now got to the stage where the subcoolers, which we've invested in, are being installed, and they've been a huge, huge success. So to put that into context, on the one ship, which was being operated in a particular way, which made the subcooler particularly valuable, we've managed to harvest $7,500 a day for us over the first couple of months of activity. And the total saving was $15,000 a day. And in the context of today's rates, that's huge. That's one ship. We're going to have these upgrades applied to five ships. And in this market, they really are a big differentiator. It makes it much, much easier for us to keep the ships employed. And of course, with LNG, that's important, because if you warm up as an LNG carrier, it costs you about $500,000 to cool down again, and do the maths at $15,000-$20,000 a day. You're not going to spend that money. But with these upgrades, we don't have that problem, because these ships get picked up by the market, and it's been extremely worthwhile. In addition, the emissions come down a lot, and we get advantages on the CII side as well. So all in all, a very well worth investment. And of course, we always look to do that with respect to our existing fleet.
Thank you, Richard. Jerry?
So as I mentioned, we have a large new building program in place. That's a total capex of about $2.3 billion. We are funding this by selling legacy assets. So we have sold 12 container vessels since we announced that we're going to focus on the gas transportation. That was a year and a half ago. Net proceeds from those sales was $470 million. We closed our previous quarter end with a cash balance of close to $350 million. Since then, we delivered the last two container vessels to their buyers. That's another $120 million. So, you know, we have a cash kitty of about $470 million. Using that cash as well as debt and, of course, cash that we are going to generate from our existing vessels, we are going to cover the this capex. So we are very well set for that. These vessels deliver, as I pointed out earlier, in 26-27, and we expect our EBITDA just on the back of the delivery of these vessels, and assuming not even a great market, we expect our EBITDA to more than double over the next couple of years. So a lot of building growth already set in.
Chris?
Yeah, as some may recall, we did a relatively large transaction last year when we acquired the 12 Avance VLGCs. For us, it was a strategic opportunity for us where we could also use the share as a currency in that transaction, and we could get vessels on the water 3 months later. So that was an important milestone for the company. For us, it's important not to bite over more than you can chew. So I think at this point in time, we are focusing on managing the investments and the achievements of last year to the best of the shareholders' interests. Focus on paying out dividends, which is our main way of returning value to our shareholders. We do have a share buyback program which we reactivate from time to time, but we predominantly use the dividends as the tool to return value to our shareholders. We have a relatively low net leverage. It went up from 20% to 33% after the transaction. So with a strong balance sheet and a relatively healthy market and solid outlooks, we'll continue to focus on paying out dividends to our shareholders also in the future.
Thank you, Christian. I didn't think I'd be asking this question about 6 months ago, but I'll ask it now. It's always that the whiff of a recession or weakening economy, if you will. Understanding there's a balance here, you provide necessary commodities, vital commodities, but also your cyclical businesses. As economies slow, potentially slow, how do you manage through that? I'll start with Christian.
Yeah, so like I said, we operate already in a very volatile market. You know, spot rates in the VLGC space is probably the most, fluctuating the most, even with VLCCs. I mean, you can have rates going from $100,000 a day to $10,000 a day in 3 weeks' time when you have these cold snaps in the States. So the way that we try to buffer that fluctuation is, like I explained earlier, spreading out our wings in the adjacent parts of the value chain so that we have other cash flows, other revenue streams, more optionality through our trading platform, and also what we're doing in other, let's say, niche markets like in India. And I think also for us, you will see us continue to maintain a relatively large part of our fleet in the time charter market. I mentioned 30 to 40% is probably going to be more like 40% going forward. We like to keep the exposure to the spot market, though, because when the spot market really moves, which typically happens when no one really expected it, you know, it's a phenomenal upside for our shareholders. So we like to keep that spot exposure. But I think for us going forward into the, let's say, under the current market environment and the circumstances, the geopolitics and so on, we'll use our platform our business model and continue with a relatively conservative chartering strategy.
Great, thank you. Ted, you want to add to that on the LPG side?
Yeah, I'd say from our perspective, I think the best lever we can pull is our cash cost per day. We've kept that, you know, fairly steady, you know, around $25,000-$26,000 a day. And, you know, that absolves a lot of sin as you go through the cycle. I mean, I think fundamentally, chartering policy helps a little bit. And, you know, I think, while no industry is recession resistant, you know, there's some things that we continue to like about our sector. You know, 45% of global LPG demand is for heating and cooking, so it's fairly inelastic. And that always provides some base demand regardless of what happens. And even in the petrochemical sector, obviously it's a very cyclical business in and of itself, and dependent on, you know, similar factors to ours in terms of overall industrial and consumer demand. But that also gives us some good visibility, and so, you know, we can moderate, you know, any number of things in our cost structure if we need to, if we see a real heavy downturn coming. So, you know, I think from our perspective, it continues to be a bit of chartering, but mainly we try to manage that cash cost per day to allow us to operate regardless of the economic environment.
And, Ted, I mean, our market is currently $40,000 a day approximately. I mean, cash break even in the mid to low 20,000 a day is still a decent market to operate in.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Randy?
Yeah, part of it is our product diversification, as I mentioned, 7 different commodities that we're transporting today, but also geographic diversification, right? Every day we are coming in and out of North America, Latin America, Asia, Europe, India, West Africa. So with that geographic diversification, that really gives us that earning stability, as I was talking about earlier. In terms of our leverage, right, we have pretty low financial leverage, so we take a little more operational leverage. We're about 60-ish, a little more than that percent spot right now, so around 40% time charter. So that 40% obviously gives us that kind of earning stability, as well as our terminal and other things. And then the spot cargoes, we're really focused more on ethane, ethylene, some of the LPG trades. So that kind of diversification helps us, you know, weather any storms that may come. All that being said, if you look at our earnings history over the last 5 years, it's been sequential growth from an EBITDA perspective, from an earnings perspective, and we fully expect 25 to continue that trend. So despite some clouds and some uncertainties on the horizon, we remain confident that our earnings will continue to grow this year.
Thank you, Randy. Richard, comments?
Yeah, I think we're probably the first into the downturn, and we batten down the hatches, and we'll be first into the upturn. And you're starting to see that now in the rates creeping up. But that's not to say it isn't hard work. And you know, day in, day out, we're chartering ships. Normally, for me, being on a panel like this is an easier day, put it that way. But that's because Øystein would quite often be on the panel, and he does a lot of the talking. I'd just like to say, since we're getting towards the end of the session, that I do believe that Marius Voss will be a superb CEO for Flex, but he won't be quite as talkative as Øystein. So it's going to mean more work for all those guys.
Fair enough. And looking at the clock, Jerry, you've got the last word.
Yeah, I think as far as the LNG market is concerned, I mean, if we move away from the short-term market and we look at the macro picture, this is a very strong market with fantastic prospects. Demand for LNG has been growing twice the demand for natural gas, and I think over the last couple of years, with of course the role that renewables are going to play and the importance of tackling the intermittency, natural gas and LNG is going to play a major role. But even more important, I think the emergence of the large data centers and their energy needs to support AI is also going to grow and drive that demand for LNG. In addition to that, when you look at the supply side, you know, we have, let's say, 400 MTPA already trading, and we have another 200 MTPA that are coming online over the next few years, and that's all projects that have taken FID and have regulatory approvals. There's another 100 15-20 MTPA that is subject to further regulatory approvals and FID. This U.S. administration, if anything, is very supportive of such projects. So I think when you look at the long-term picture for demand for LNG as well as the supply of the molecule, it's actually quite good, almost irrespective of the short-term volatility.
Great, Jerry. That takes us right down to the wire. I can't thank you gentlemen enough. It was a great discussion. I very much appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for sitting in.